Welcome to episode 12 of Old Stories, New Information. I'm your host, Brent Colley, and on today's episode, I'm joined by Marge Smith, a friend of mine, historian, educator, Labrador mommy, and the curator of Kent Historical Society. So welcome, Marge. I'm so happy that you could be here with us today.
Well, I'm very happy to be a part of this. This is an amazing program, and I'm particularly honored to be following last week's chat with my pal, Merrill Rogers.
Well, yeah, and for the listeners, it was Marge and Ed Kirby that set the hook in me, that got me to the Sharon Historical Society. Obviously, Liz Shapiro reeled me in, and we started in 2007 there. Then I'd stay there until 2018. So. And if I'm being full disclosure, she also tricked me into politics, too. But from there, Marge introduced me to the Kent Historical Society. And at that time, you guys were operating out of the Swift House down in South Main Street, right?
Well, yes and no. We had our office and our archives down there in an old house that's owned by the town. But we owned a pre-revolutionary house up on about 2 miles north of Kent in the Flanders center of Kent, which I'll talk about in a minute. And about 10, 15 years ago, decided to buy a little cottage next to it just so that we could have everything all together on our own campus, actually suggested to us by Liz Shapiro. So we are all now up in Flanders.
Okay.
With the Kent Historical Society, we're not nearly as old as the venerable Sharon Historical Society, but our house that we have is, I believe, even older than the Gay Hoyt House. And it was in the original center of Kent. It was in an area called Flanders. It's a combination residential commercial building that had a general store on the first floor, a butcher shop in the cellar, a fur trading post on the second floor, all adjacent to the family quarters that were on the south side of the house. It was the church was right across the road, the Congregational Church at that point, which was the only one in town. So it was a real gathering place for everybody.
So that's Seven Hearths. Now, how did you guys obtain that building?
Well, it was bought in 1919 from a New York artist named George Lawrence Nelson, who had been coming up for weekends for years. He was part of the Litchfield Hills Art Colony, which certainly encompassed Sharon, all the surrounding towns. There were a lot of really interesting, creative people up here. And he was a part of that. And he moved up here full-time during the Depression, and because he had to give up his apartment in New York City. They lost a lot of money during the Depression. And when he died, he left it to the Kent Historical Society in 1978.
Wow. Yeah, I remember when you guys were renovating the building, and I got a great look at his artwork when we were redoing the website for you. And it really showcased his artistic ability, which was a larger scale than I expected. I personally like his landscapes and his still lives. Those are my favorite. But what he did with people and scenes was impressive, too.
Well, he was a really well-known artist in that day, and the Litchfield Art Colony actually morphed into the Kent Art Association, which has just celebrated its 100th anniversary. But Nelson was a gifted lithographer. He made his money doing portraits, society portraits in New York City, but he loved doing the local landscapes along with a lot of his Litchfield Hills colleagues. They would gather together and go out and paint the Housatonic River. They painted the mountains. They just really documented what this area looked like in that era, and it was just amazing. And, again, it lives on as the Kent Art Association.
Yeah, I never knew that's how that association got started. That's interesting. Yeah, you're right. He did capture most of what we see in the present day, especially another impressive one was the Kent Falls one that he did.
Yes.
I like the fact that his brother's name was Nelson Nelson.
Yeah, I well, that's a very long story that would take a whole 18 minutes to explain. But yes, Nelson was a very interesting person, too. They were the children of two other very well-known artists named Carl and Alice Kerr Nelson Hirschberg. And I'll leave it at that. It was a big artistic family, so he's got a lot of heritage. And I really encourage people to come up and see his artwork, which is in Seven Hearths, along with a lot of the other earlier, we have two stories that we tell there. We tell the story of Mr. Nelson, and we tell the story of the very important fledgling town of Kent, which is cool.
Okay, yeah, that's a neat thing. Like, there's a great story behind why he bought it, and then I I've heard he had a journal about what they found. Is that true?
Yep. Well, he was really, when he bought it, and it was not in shambles. The structure of the building was fine, but it was fairly dirty. It had been lived in by a couple of two or three families that really hadn't taken care of it. They didn't own it. They were just renters, probably working at the furnace, or they might have been local farmers. And so he had to clean it out and fix it up, and he became just so impressed with its early days. And he kept a journal, which he eventually turned into a memoir that he called New Life for Old Timber. And he took great pains to restore it really carefully. He furnished it as far as possible with period furniture, which he often bought from tag sales in the neighborhood. He and his wife, Helen, finally moved up here, as I said, full-time during the Depression, at which point they finally installed more modern conveniences such as electricity and indoor plumbing. And if you will bear with me, I'd love to read a little excerpt from New Life for Old Timber when he talks about cleaning out the well, because they initially just used this outdoor well, and it was a mess. And he said, "Elsewhere I had descended a well to clean and scald the interior after a woodchuck had chosen it as an ideal place for suicide. I found the bottom had been dug down to flat rock. As our well gave no evidence of a hard bottom, the work of cleaning it out had been decided upon, with the result that over 4 feet of fine silt, as smooth as talcum powder, was brought to the surface. Then followed a collection of handmade tools, hammers, screwdrivers, meat hooks, all quaintly different from our present machined varieties, which were brought to the service. There were also some tin milk pails, which had partially disintegrated instead of rusting away, and augmenting this collection of antiques were a three-pronged fork, a broad-ended knife, undoubtedly handy for scooping up peas, or for balancing a fried egg on its tip. Last but not least, a nicely turned earthenware jug, a few ham bones were recovered." And we still have some of those relics. We've got the fork, we've got the knife, and we've got that beautiful earthenware jug. And that just shows you, I think, how much Nelson was connecting to the people who had lived in that house. And I just really love musing on that connection. And then one other, and then I'll stop reading from this, I think. But he and Helen, I think, for years fought the need to have electricity and plumbing. They were only up here on weekends, and it was to them, he said, it was a period indubitably one of romance, enhanced by contrast with a life in a New York City apartment. For years, we used the soft light of kerosene lamps to read by in the evenings and candles to go to bed with.
Yeah, that must have been crazy. I mean, I remember kerosene lamps growing up in my childhood. They didn't toss off a lot of light, but I remember they had this unique smell to them.
Yeah, yeah, and a beautiful, beautiful glow. So, yeah, they were just, I guess, playing country folks. And then reality hit. They lost all their money during the Depression, so they came up and eventually in the 1930s put in plumbing. And in order to do that, he really started looking around the house and trying to figure out what to do where. And looking on the second floor, he said that he decided it was evident that the old ballroom on the second floor had played a part in the life of the earlier days that we associate today in a wider sense with community houses. We were told of meetings, quilting parties, and dances which were held there. For a time, it was used as a school. One feature of the former ballroom was its diminutive fireplace, hardly big enough to accommodate a stove-length stick of wood. These I have seen elsewhere in the hallways or bedrooms. The other upstairs fireplace in our guest room is about twice the size. There were actually seven fireplaces in the house, and that was at that point that they decided to name the house Seven Hearths. But now here comes the gist of our story. He said, we found the ballroom divided by a partition, and without this provision, there would have only been two chambers. In fact, it had been sectioned off into three rooms. One remained dark, except for a dim light that filtered through some panes in the door. I therefore took down the partition, causing the darkened section, and let the other remain, so that now four chambers were available. Most of the rear was unfinished storage space, including a fur trading post connected with the store by a second back stairs. One could see the names of mink and fox and other skins marked in blue chalk on the beams. Large painted letters indicated the bought and sold sections. In part of this space, our new bathroom took shape.
Now that's the hidden history, new information part that I like. You know, that that journal, because you guys were doing your own renovations, that kind of gave you the clues that you needed to figure out, you know, what you needed in your own renovations. And that, how did that all happen on your end?
Well, we weren't doing too many renovations at first, but then we had to move the storage. Mr. Nelson's artwork had all been stored in part of that storage space. And we needed, for reasons that are too complicated to explain, to change that. And we also really started looking at new life for old timber. We read it again and again and again and thought, well, we've got to check this out because fur trading posts were unheard of around here. So we decided to investigate that. We had Hudson Valley Preservation come up, Mason Lord with his little borescope, and drilled a hole in the sheetrock ceiling of Nelson's bathroom. And very short order, Mason found the word mink in chalk on one of the beams above our head. So we decided, okay, this is it. We're going to see what we can do with this. So we made the decision to move all the artwork up to our office. We had moved by that time, as I said, up to next to Seven Hearths. We moved all the artwork up there and took down all the walls and the ceiling in Nelson's bathroom. And we found mink in two or three places. We found several initials in blue chalk that were probably the fur traders. In one place on the ceiling is the letters B-A-R, which was the way they would spell bear, bar.
Wow. Huh.
And Nelson had put a set of stairs there. He'd moved the stairs because the area where the old stairs had been, he turned into his workroom. He did a lot of painting conservation. So he built a set of stairs right adjacent to the bathroom. We realized that we had to take that set of stairs out because we were still looking for stuff. He noted that he had removed the original attic stairs, but his description of where they had been was cryptic, to say the least. We couldn't figure it out until finally our awesome restoration contractor, Mark Peterson, and board members Jeff Morgan and Roger Gonzalez decided to prowl around in the attic to see if we could figure out where those earlier stairs went. And they finally did. They realized there was a section of boards that didn't fit, and that's where it was. So we rebuilt those stairs, removed the stairs that Nelson had put in, and when we did that, there was the word bought painted in big red letters on the beam. And that was really cool because it really started us looking around the room and seeing how the fur traders would have come up from the main floor to this attic, gotten a trade-in for the pelts. It was all barter at that point. And then they could go back down to the store that was on the first floor and trade it in for spices or ribbon or, you know, cloth that they couldn't have for themselves. So it was just part of the real barter area.
It's just so neat. And, you know, and you realize, especially this time of year, you know, how many different types of furred animals there are in our region through the tracks, through the snow. And, you know, we're pretty much a green belt. So it must have been an abundance of furs of all different shapes and sizes and kinds. I mean, especially beaver. I mean, beaver, they're amazing in what they do, but that they move on and on and on and build new locations. So that's an interesting clue. And I like the way you guys did the exhibit because it does point to the fact that it was a barter system. And the way it's set up down there, you really get that, you get that sense of what it was like. It's almost like you're going back in time.
Well, it is. And so far as we know, there's no other fur trading post interpretation open to the public anywhere in New England except way, way, way up in northern Maine. We have a lot of pelts that people have given us, including a huge beaver pelt on a stretcher. We've bought some others. We have traps. We have stretchers. We don't know exactly how the room was set up, but when you walk into it, it really takes you back in time. And it's interesting for me to see particularly when the like high school age kids come in and they see all the pelts and they go, ew, this is wrong, this is terrible. And we ask them, well, how do you stay warm in the wintertime? And you see the little brain start to click and they realize, oh, okay, we've got, you know, fleece. Well, they didn't have fleece back in those days. So everybody needed these pelts to stay warm and they didn't waste any part of the animals. We give them a real life lesson on how good we've got it these days and how you have to compare your own life to times in past to just understand what it was all about.
No, it's true. And you also capture something that maybe has been lost, you know, over the course of time, in that trading, especially with fur trading, is a main big reason why Europeans came to our shores to trade. It was a very important part of the transition from Europe to America was the goods that were here, including the furs. I mean, Adrian Block, who found Hartford, was looking for furs in that process, and that's how he came up the Connecticut, and obviously he made another trip up the Hudson, as many other traders did. I mean, New York City, you know, then New Amsterdam, that was a big hub for trading furs. And like you said, the beavers, they can get to a decent size. I mean, the largest beaver on record is probably above 100 pounds, so it's a good-sized lab, if you will.
Yeah, there was a huge draw up here. I think it was probably the fur trade and the iron industry that drew people to this northwest Connecticut. And the Dutch settlers were very involved in the fur trade. Our local Scaticook Indians here were a big part of this. And we know the names of some of the white men because we've got their initials carved on chalk on the walls. But a lot of the Scaticooks came in and traded, too. It was a very, very important building. This is where they came. There was nothing else like this anywhere in this area. I mean, there might have been in various towns, but there's nothing that can be seen today that represents this. It was an important part of life.
Yeah, because those are the things. Like, you know, you guys dropped down to Housatonic, and where the majority of our bridges are, they were called fording places. So it was, for lack of a better term, shallow areas in the river.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Housatonic is so much different now than it was then. Like, the dam wasn't there. So there were low spots, and they called them fords, and that's where they crossed. So you could go from that location back into, say, Sharon, or, you know, over to Kent, Warren. You know, we were all interconnected in that space, so it's a really good location for that purpose, because you were kind of the center, the hub.
I forgot to mention that there's a brook that goes right by the house, and there were several grist mills. There was a fulling mill, and the last use of the stream downstream was a tanning factory there. So that the pelts that were the hides, I guess they were called hides when they were brought in, or the pelts they were brought in, then they were taken to the tannery and cured, and then they could be turned into whatever articles of clothing people wanted. And it was a stinky, smelly business, and it had to be the most downstream operation on that stream. And that's all within a few hundred feet, really, of Seven Hearts. It was a really, really, really busy area.
No, it's neat. I love the fact that you guys, you know, continue that story. And you guys recently won an award. Was that the what award was that with Connecticut?
We definitely did. Chris Wigren, who still is the deputy director of Preservation Connecticut, we had alerted him to what we were doing, and he finally came up, and his eyes just popped out. He said he'd never heard of anything like it anywhere in New England before, and so he kept track of what we were doing. And we started, I think, in 2014. And in 2022, we got a call from Chris in Preservation Connecticut and said they would like to give us an award of excellence. So we did. It was very, very exciting. It made all of our hard work worthwhile, and it's nice to have the little award plaque just outside the fur trading area. So we're very proud.
You should be. You really should. And, you know, I think people, now that they're aware of it, will hopefully come down and see it themselves. It's powerful. But then it also ties to the artwork and the renovations of the house itself. So you have a really nice combination of a lot of different histories that, in a fun way, ties to what we still are in terms of people moving up here from Manhattan or Brooklyn or other parts of the city to here, and then finding it's so pleasant that they stay.
Absolutely.
So that's kind of woven in that story. So I'm so happy that you were able to share that with us today. If they want to come see the house, when's the best times?
Off season, we do it any time by appointment. Jeffrey and I especially love taking people through the house. So you just contact the office. The information's on our website, and just come, make an appointment. We'll take you through. And then during the summer, we generally have exhibits. We're not quite sure yet what this summer's exhibit is going to be, but it is accessible year-round by appointment, and we would love to have people come.
Okay, great. All right, well, Marge, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, no, it's a great pleasure. And as we've noted in past episodes, if you found this of interest, there's an email account. You can write us at stories@robinhoodradio.com. Tell us what you like, and that's how we'll circle back. In the next episode, we'll discuss how a beloved bike mechanic down in Sharon Valley, known to local children as Boo Boo, the new information of the story is that a local businessman with a metal detector confirmed this, and Ray Akhtar Jr., a great friend of mine, will be the guest on this one. So until next time, be well and always do right. This will gratify some people and astonish the rest. Enjoy your week.
Old Stories, New Information with Brent Colley is produced at the studios of WHDD 91.9 FM, RobinHoodRadio.com, Sharon, Connecticut.